Hey, welcome back. Just a reminder, coming up in the second half of the show, the top of the next hour, the sexy psychic Sloane Bella will be here. Maybe I'll get her to weigh in on my nascent psychic ability, right, as if. And she'll also, no doubt, do some predictions. We'll talk about some celebrity deaths with her. She'll have maybe some communications from the other side. And David Gardner is still with us. We will take calls with David at the bottom of this hour, talking murder, lies, and cover-ups. A controversial Korean laboratory has successfully cloned the world's smallest living dog 49 times for a commercial breeder. Miracle Millie, a six-year-old chihuahua who lives with her owner in Florida, weighed less than an ounce and could fit in a teaspoon when she was born. The tiny pet, who entered the record books in 2013 and weighs just over a pound, is the smallest dog living in terms of height, standing at just 3.8 inches tall. She was cloned at the Suam Biotech Research Foundation in Seoul, South Korea, in August last year. And the company, which reportedly charges $100,000 to bring a pet back to life, has cloned hundreds of pets. Hey, George Norrie is returning to Asheville at the Diana Wortham Theater in, when is that happening now? Oh, dear. August the 25th. There we go. Saturday, August the 25th, 2018. He's returning to beautiful Asheville, North Carolina for an amazing show with special guests the Rocket Man, David Adair, and ufologist Micah Hanks discussing Area 51. William Fortschen, author of The Final Day and One Year After, speaking about solar attacks on our planet and our grid. Asheville's own paranormal investigator Joshua P. Warren and spiritual teacher and psychic medium Vincent Jenna. There'll be a live band, audience participation, and a meet and greet to follow. For tickets, call 828-257-4530, 828-257-4530, or go to dwtheater.com, dwtheater, theatre.com, and click the buy tickets. Again, George Norrie returning to Asheville at the Diana Wortham Theater. That's Saturday, August the 25th from 5 to 8 p.m. When we come back, more of my conversation with David Gardner and Elvis Presley's participation in an FBI sting operation. Stay with us on Coast to Coast AM. David Gardner stays with us. Murder, lies, and cover-ups. Elvis Presley, David, his involvement in this FBI sting called Operation Fountain Pen. What was it, and how did Elvis get involved?
Well, this is one of these fascinating stories that came through research, and there's a lot of FBI records on Elvis. And this whole episode is included in the FBI file on Elvis Presley. Basically, it was an opportunity for Elvis to make good on his pledge to become a federal agent. What happened was, unbelievably, in about 1976, despite all the money he'd made, Elvis was faced with the possibility of going broke. I mean, I think he was always, given cars away. He was a very, very generous guy, and not that careful about keeping tabs on his cash. So they looked, I think his father, who was his business manager, Vernon, started looking to sell one of his planes, Lockheed Jetstar. And he started to sort of wonder about some of the people inquiring about buying it. It seemed a bit shady. So Elvis actually went to the FBI and said, suggested putting the plane up for sale as a sort of bait to tempt out some of these crooks. What happened was the people that made contact were involved in this mob-connected gang called the Fraternity. And then we involved apparently a loosening group. This is according to the file. A loosening group comprised of about 30 to 40 of the world's top con men. They were involved in $2 billion worth of fraud around the world. And the FBI file follows this case. A guy called Fred Pro contacted Elvis's father to try and buy the plane, not knowing that two FBI undercover FBI agents, not Elvis. Incidentally, I think that would be trouble. It might be difficult for him to go undercover. But a couple of the FBI agents sort of followed the whole trail of this story, and they pretended to be involved in the sale. What happened in a nutshell is that Pro took out a $1 million mortgage on the plane and then basically left the bank with holding the plane and took the money. And then the FBI pounced and arrested him. But what is fascinating, and what again drew me to looking closer at the actual death itself, was that Elvis and Vernon were supposed to give evidence about this whole case on the day that Elvis died. Now that seems very suspicious to me, and it made me think and look into this a little bit further.
All right, so let's sort of trace the final hours of Elvis Presley, August 16th. You know, like a lot of musical performers, his day was sort of turned upside down. What would have been normally a daytime activity for us, he did it in the nighttime. Did he not return from the dentist like after midnight or something like that? I mean, who else could have a dentist appointment at midnight but Elvis Presley? But walk us through his final hours after he returns home from the dentist.
Yeah, I think he was with his girlfriend, Ginger Olden. They got back about 12:30 a.m. from the dentist. And unsurprisingly, he's not sleeping. I think at about 2:15, he calls his kind of his own personal physician, Dr. Nick, who was his kind of enabler, to get some more painkillers. His entourage get him some more pills. And I think this is, again, typical of that kind of lifestyle. At 4 o'clock in the morning, Elvis woke up his first cousin, Billy Smith, to play a game of racquetball. Because I guess that's what they were doing. That's what they would do for Elvis. He's the Memphis Mafia. They were around to do this kind of thing. You know, they would jump. When Elvis called, they would jump. So he played a game of racquetball, sang a couple of songs at the piano. He had a piano out in the racquetball court. Apparently sang Unchained Melody and Blue Eyes Crying in the Rain, effectively his last performance. And then 6 a.m., when some people are kind of thinking about getting up, Elvis went to bed. Supposedly with Ginger, and took his first packet of prescription pills, which he would normally take to get him to sleep. So around that time, he would just hang out in his room. At 8 o'clock, still unable to get to sleep, had some more drugs. 9 o'clock, still awake, he goes into his bathroom, which is kind of kitted out. I think it's like a palace in his bathroom at Graceland. Ginger's asleep then. So this is 9 o'clock in the morning. And at 2 p.m. that day, Ginger woke up and found that Elvis is gone. She goes into the bathroom, and that's when she finds his body on the floor in front of the toilet. So we're talking about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and you know, very shortly after that, Elvis is pronounced dead.
Not only was he gone, I mean, he was not only gone, he was way, way gone, almost unrecognizable. So how long had he been dead, do we know?
We don't know exactly, I mean, but some hours. And again, this is where the kind of part of the cover-up comes in. In this case, the cover-up is entirely trying to help their old friend. I spoke to Joe Esposito, who was Elvis's best man and his kind of de facto assistant for many years. Joe himself died a year or so ago, but before he died, we had a kind of long chat about this whole situation and, you know, defining being in Joe's life. And he was a great friend of Elvis for many years. And he actually explained, because when the cops got there, somewhat similar to Marilyn, we were talking about earlier, that the place had been cleaned up. Any sign of any drug was all cleared away. Everything looked kind of clean as a whistle. But Joe told me that he was just trying to protect Elvis's reputation. And in fact, when he was first asked how Elvis was found, he said Elvis was found in bed, which is not the case. But he didn't want the world and Elvis's millions of fans to know that basically Elvis, you know, was slumped down by the toilet with his pants down by his ankles. I mean, it's an inauspicious death for such a hero to so many people. So that was a cover-up, but it was a cover-up with good intentions, I guess.
The again, you know, the commonality here, we see this rush to judgment. The autopsy, the person who performed the autopsy didn't wait for the toxicology reports, just said that he died of heart failure. Well, Of course he died of heart failure. When you die, your heart stops. I mean, that says nothing. Why the rush to judgment here?
It does. Well, I mean, again, there was some logic to that, even though it wouldn't be, it's not a good logic, but there was a logic. I mean, when people got to hear about Elvis dying, there was pandemonium around Graceland. There were fans were around the gates. There was thousands of people in Memphis mourning, basically. And so what the authorities, I guess, thought it was the best thing to do, and certainly the people around Elvis thought it was the best thing to do, was to come up with a reason pretty quickly to not upset people. And a heart attack, you know, anyone can have a heart attack. It wasn't complicated. You know, the reality that Elvis died through what essentially a drug overdose is, you know, it's questionable about why that drug overdose was taken. That we go into it in the book. But I think it was felt that a neat answer to why he died would help all around at the time. And certainly Elvis's friends and his doctor, Dr. Nick, were very keen to preserve his reputation and preserve his image.
Sure, he was Tennessee's number one taxpayer. He was their beloved, well, he was born in Mississippi, but he was sort of their adopted beloved son. So to protect his image. But as you point out in the book, some interesting things in terms of, there were a number of toxicology reports, and one of them showed a lethal dose of codeine. Or not a lethal dose, but some codeine in his system, and Elvis was allergic to codeine, correct?
Indeed, and that's another strange thing. You know, you keep coming up with these strange findings, which, again, haven't really been that explored at the time. It was widely known to Elvis's friends, and certainly his entourage, that Elvis was allergic to codeine. I mean, he knew it. He was like a pharmacologist. He knew everything he was taking. He took about too much of his time working up out what he was taking and what he wasn't. So he knew codeine was going to cause him problems. And I spoke to a number of members of the Memphis Mafia who confirmed that. And yet, there in the autopsy, there were a total of 14 different types of drugs in his body, including 10 times the normal dosage of codeine. Which would make no sense because he would know not to take it. He'd had small amounts before and given a huge bad reaction. So why codeine? Why would codeine be in his body? And one suggestion would be that he was giving it surreptitiously, and that is basically the cause why he died.
So someone tricked him into taking codeine, knowing that he was allergic.
Yeah, we're in the supposition here. So the suggestion would be that someone switched pills. It's not impossible, and I always had lots of people coming and going. It wouldn't have been impossible to get into Graceland. I know certainly some people close to him believe he was murdered. Susanna Lee, who was an actress who was in one of his movies and who worked for a while at Graceland, certainly believed that was the case. She said that Dick Grobe, who was Elvis's security boss at one time, she said that he certainly believed that was the case. It's also said that Vernon, Elvis's dad, felt that there was more to it. I mean, he believed there was a chance that Elvis had been murdered. So, this isn't just wild speculation. There are some people who knew Elvis very well who felt strongly that there was more to this than met the eye.
And so does it come back again to Elvis's participation in Operation Fountain Pen that busted up, or at least it put a number of mobsters behind bars? Or had Elvis participated in the trial, it would have certainly have done that, yeah.
Well, yeah, again, had Elvis given evidence, he wouldn't have put people away per se. He didn't have any great insight into how this Operation Fountain Pen worked or into the fraud other than involvement of his own plane. What it would have done is put some very unwanted public attention on what was going on. Elvis giving evidence about a criminal criminal fraternity. That was news around the world. This was a very low key, very lucrative mob operation, and which, as I said, $2 billion they're talking about. That's a lot of money. So there was a lot at stake, and the sense is that had Elvis given details of this into a court, then basically a lot of the money making would be jeopardized.
And what about Colonel Tom Parker's role in this? I mean, as you point out, very shady character. Certainly wasn't a colonel. Tom Parker wasn't his real name. I think he came from the Netherlands. It's also been reported, I believe, that he skipped out of the Netherlands, may have been involved in a murder, fled to the United States, took on this new identity, had his connections and problems with the mob. Could this have been done with Colonel Tom's knowledge, tacit approval, participation?
I mean, with Colonel Tom Parker, it's hard. You can't negate anything. Obviously, Elvis was his cash cow, so it would be hard to think that he would want to lose that. I don't know how desperate he was. I don't know what kind of debts he may have had. Again, supposition, but he certainly had some dodgy friends, put it that way.
I was going to ask you again about the other character in this saga, which is, of course, Dr. Nicopoulos, Dr. Nick.
Yeah.
I mean, he's taken a lot of the blame over the years because Elvis apparently had this addiction to prescription drugs, and Dr. Nick was seen as an enabler. But does this then discount that it wasn't overprescribing drugs that led to Elvis's death? I mean, if he was poisoned with codeine, that would certainly exonerate Dr. Nick, would it not?
To a certain extent, yeah. I mean, he certainly did overprescribe Elvis with drugs, and for many years he was prescribing all manner of drugs to Elvis. So there's no doubt about that. But I spoke again to Dr. Nick before he died, and he was insistent that none of these were the reason for his death. He felt that it was to do with a bowel complaint that Elvis had. So he sticks to his story of something very different entirely. But yes, to a certain extent, this would put a different focus on everything to a certain extent in my eye. You know, it's always seemed to me a bit of a tragedy that someone like Elvis, who was such a hero to so many people, should have died in such inauspicious circumstances. Could it be that Elvis, in his own way, died a hero, that he was trying to expose wrongdoing and he paid the price for that? I mean, is that a possibility? That would put a very different ending on a kind of incredible life story.
Well, Elvis had Dr. Nick and Michael Jackson, who we'll delve into here in a few moments as we head into a break. Michael Jackson had Dr. Conrad Murray, another enabler. We'll talk about that as well when we come back. David Gardner is with us, the author of Murder, Lies, and Cover-Ups, Who Killed Marilyn Monroe, JFK, Michael Jackson, Elvis Presley, and Princess Diana. And just a reminder, we'll open up the phone lines as well. This half hour, questions and comments for David Gardner. If you want to find out a little bit more about Elvis's death, Marilyn Monroe's death, the circumstances surrounding Michael Jackson's shocking death. Just 9 years ago, we marked that anniversary back in May. All right, taking us into the break, Rufus Thomas, an all-night worker, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Stay with us. Hey, welcome back. Say hello on Twitter, at Richard Serrett. S-Y, because I love you, R-E-T-T. David Gardner is with us, Murder, Lies, and Cover-Ups. And when we come back, we'll take your questions and comments, and we'll talk about Michael Jackson's final hours and the role that Dr. Conrad Murray played in his untimely death. Back with more right here on Coast to Coast AM. Stay with us. David Gardner is with us. Before we go to the calls, David, in I think it was March of 2009 when Michael Jackson held that press conference in London announcing this in residence concert series at the O2 Arena in London, and something like he was going to do, was it 50 dates? And I, like a lot of people, saw this very frail, sickly looking Michael Jackson, just a shell of his former self, thinking, my word, you know, he's got no business getting back up on stage. What possessed him? Why did he need the money at this stage of his career?
Good question. I mean, again, he'd made a fortune, several fortunes, but he needed the cash. He, like Elvis, again, interesting the parallels that run through some of these legendary deaths, but like Elvis, he'd gone through money like water. So yes, money was definitely something he wanted. He also wanted to sort of buy some security for his children. He wanted to settle down. He was living something of a sort of nomadic lifestyle at that time. He was in Vegas and in LA, and he was kind of all over in the Middle East for a while with his kids. Supposedly wanted to settle down with them. And being a performer, there was a competitive side too. I think Prince had done a similar number of concerts in a row, and Elvis, kind of ever the professional, ever the, you know, the competitive guy, wanted to do one more than in a row than Prince had done.
But the promoters, was it, I believe it was AEG Live, they must have known he was in no condition to perform.
Well, certainly there was a real concern. I mean, I covered every day of the trial in Los Angeles of Conrad Murray, and that was very much a feature of the trial, and the senior executives from AEG gave evidence in court. And yes, Jackson signed a contract, and they then, AEG, invested quite some considerable money and effort into promoting the concerts. And I think what happened was Jackson was rehearsing at the Staples Center in LA with some top guys, and it became extremely clear that he wasn't a well guy. I think at one point, supposedly someone said you could actually see the heart beating in his chest. He was that thin and that pale. I mean, he was not a well man. Many listeners may well have seen the This Is It movie made after Jackson's death, and that makes it clear there was some numbers. He was still Michael Jackson. He could still sing. He could still do some of the dance numbers, but some of that footage was taken for the good nights, and there were many, many bad nights too, and he was struggling. So there was a pressure on him, a strong pressure on him to perform. And of course, as we mentioned before, the guy couldn't sleep. So, you know, not only was he struggling physically to keep up with the sort of grueling rehearsal with the knowledge that he had this huge commitment in front of him, he was going days and days without sleep. At the trial, it came out that he kind of had the Guinness record for not sleeping 60 days because he'd apparently taken propofol, which the anaesthetic does not actually give you proper sleep. It's REM sleep. So he was effectively awake for 60 days before he died, which is quite some incredible thought.
How did he hook up with Dr. Conrad Murray, someone who, again, another enabler?
Yeah. Murray was, at that time when they met, it was in Vegas, when Jackson was living in Vegas, and he did a doctor, Conrad Murray came on the scene. Murray had his own problems financially. He was supposedly in debt. I think he's behind with his mortgage. He was looking for money. He also was starstruck, I think he'd probably admit that, by Jackson, and they became friends, and he became his doctor. One of the reasons they became his doctor is because he was willing to help provide the medication that Jackson wanted. So that relationship turned from being his local doctor in Vegas, and then when Jackson had the O2 concert coming up, he asked Murray to go with him to London, and he was going to pay him $100,000 a month to be his physician. So that worked there was a strong financial incentive for Murray too.
And the morning that he died, I guess it was around 10 in the morning, what happened? Murray administers, finally gives in to Michael's wishes and administers milk, as he called it, the propofol. How much did he give him, and where was Dr. Murray when Jackson breathed his last?
Well, Murray apparently was something of a womanizer, and he administered propofol. Again, similar to Elvis, over the morning and the early hours, there'd been a gradual process. You know, he'd given various other drugs to Jackson to try and help Jackson to sleep, and eventually given in and administered propofol, which is given by an injection with a feed from as it would be in a hospital bed. And then he was outside the room on the phone to his various girlfriends. When he came back in, Jackson wasn't breathing. And then began a systematic attempt at cover up, which he hoped that, I guess, that Jackson survived and that the whole thing could be swept under the carpet. But as he tried to get drugs removed and try to cover up his own behavior while Jackson was still, while the medics and paramedics were still trying to save Jackson, I mean, that was all brought out of the trial, and that was all part of his, ultimately, some of the reasons why he was found guilty and jailed for 4 years.
Did I read in your book, David, that at one point, and this came from Jackson's security guard, who was also at the bedside, that Dr. Conrad Murray was attempting to administer CPR on Michael with one hand because he had a phone in the other?
Indeed, which I think, you know, any kind of student doctor with the meagerest of a medical education would tell you that's virtually impossible. And something which, again, one wonders whether Jackson could have been saved, quicker action. I mean, we never know with these things, but yes, certainly his behavior in the minutes and hours after Jackson stopped breathing were reprehensible, and certainly contributed in some way. One of the things specifically about Jackson, I mean, we know kind of how he died, and we know that propofol was the reason. What I take issue with, I think to a certain extent, Murray was a scapegoat. Undeniably, he was there at the time, and he administered propofol, so he should be held to account. But he was not alone. I think other doctors certainly administered propofol earlier to Jackson, and other drugs, pain medication. And there was an investigation by the police after Jackson's death, which brought up some of these names. So I think more should have been done to bring those other doctors to account, and certainly the medical profession as a whole to account, because I think it's not just Jackson, the likes of Michael Jackson, the likes of Elvis Presley and Prince who suffer with this. It's ordinary Americans, ordinary people around the world who are caught in this sort of spiral of addiction to medication. I think the White House gave some figures that 120 Americans a day die from drug overdoses, most of those involving legal prescription drugs. And that's more than the number of people killed each day in car crashes across the state. So, you know, this is not just celebrities. This is everyone. And I think they missed a serious trick on the Michael Jackson case to actually send a message out there that enabling people by providing these this prescription medication cannot be tolerated. And that it struck me as they kind of really limited this whole investigation to Murray when it should have been much deeper and more intense.
All right, let's go to the wild card line. First out of the chute is Carlos in Oahu, Hawaii. Carlos, welcome to Coast.
Hello, Richard.
Hi there.
The last time I spoke with you, I made the point about quantum teleportation and the fact that it's possible to resurrect a person who's dead. If they die out of sequence, the body can be then transported back into sequence and the life force is restored. I just wanted to recapitulate that point because I'm going to show you how it applies. Robert Robbins, a mutual friend of ours, is alive and well.
Well, Carlos, forgive me, but right now we're talking to David Gardner about Marilyn Monroe and Elvis and Michael Jackson. Do you have a question specific to that? And we can, you know, the next time I do a Friday night open lines, you call in and you can fill your boots and tell me all about that. But right now, I'd like you to maybe direct a question to David Gardner, if you could.
And then we'll leave the subject of Art Bell alone for now. Marilyn Monroe, the night that she died, there were telephone records that showed she had repeated calls back and forth to Robert Kennedy and to Peter Lawford. And it's my understanding that they were enticing her, please, Rose, just go ahead and do it. Do it already. Get it done. And so she complied because she was under pressure to terminate the identity of Marilyn Monroe because Marilyn Monroe was about to be subpoenaed by the FBI because J. Edgar Hoover wanted to depose her pertaining to what she knew about activities within the Kennedy administration. And the point that I'm making is, David, do you know of, in the case of Elvis Presley, Michael Jackson, Marilyn Monroe, and others, Have you ever heard allegations that they were terminated, that they terminated those personas and that they were resurrected and they came back to life under other identities?
Sort of a witness protection program? Is that the idea, a witness protection program?
Well, there's certainly stories about Elvis working in a grocery store in, I don't know, there are all sorts of stories about Elvis still being alive, and strange enough, there's quite a popular idea that Michael Jackson is still alive, too. I know there's a couple of websites devoted to that. I have no idea how or why, but...
What about Marilyn's phone records, though? That was an interesting point that Carlos made. Marilyn's phone records. I mean, who was she on the phone with? Yeah, sure. She had a phone in her hand when she died.
Yeah, she certainly was on the phone to Peter Lawford early in the evening, and there's it was Peter Lawford, who was a close friend of the Kennedys, who was very much their kind of contact, their go-between. In fact, that's how she first met RFK and Bobby, through Peter Lawford, who was married to their sister. So yeah, he was certainly involved. Quite how much he was involved is another question. There's another suggestion, I think several biographers suggested that Peter Lawford actually went over to the house and oversaw the cover-up. And that's the interesting thing. There's the fact that Eunice Murray, the housekeeper, and the doctor and the psychologist all kind of changed their story in such a... And the way they did it and the way it was accepted suggests that they were told to do that. And again, the question is, who were they told to do it by? So, you know, the questions remain. I'm by no means saying I'm solving this mystery, but I think it bears further examination.
Linda is in Windsor, Canada. Good evening, good morning, Linda. Welcome to Coast to Coast.
Hi, this is so interesting. I've read the book, Marilyn, years and years ago. But in it, I don't know who wrote it, but... It was quoted saying that her hairdresser had said that Marilyn told them rather discreetly that if the people of America knew what the government was into or doing, they would be in an uproar. And we were just wondering, is it like what Kennedy was going to reveal, like the secret societies, something, you know, along that line? Dorothy Kilgallen, who was also, you know, disposed of, was just on the verge of exposing something really big. We just wondered, do you have any idea what that could be about?
Well, I think certainly the idea was that Marilyn had this diary that she was very good at writing a diary every night, and she wrote supposedly about her relationships with the Kennedys in that diary. And after her death, someone said, one of the medical examiners said that the diary, he'd seen the diary in the medical ward, but then it disappeared and they couldn't find it, and it was never seen again. So it suggests that what happened was that Marilyn actually detailed her relationship. So for that to come out after her death would have been huge for the Kennedys. I mean, absolutely, it would have destroyed them. And obviously, if she'd still been alive and she talked about it, you know, someone like Marilyn Monroe, that indeed would have been huge too. So that's what really gets you thinking about the reasons why she would have, other people would have wanted her dead. You know, big reasons.
It's all about that little black book.
Wonderful thing. Indeed, it comes down to the little black book, the red book, yeah. Yeah.
All right, Linda, thank you for that. Annie's in Alabama. Let's try to squeeze Annie in here. Annie, your question for David Gardner.
Yes, Mr. Gardner, it's suspicious to do laundry right after a suspicious death. Evidently, someone might have been attempting to wash away evidence. And another thing is, Elvis Presley unrecognizable? Yeah, that adds up. Witness protection program, substitution of a corpse. Another thing is the insurance on the plane. There must have been a lot of insurance on that plane to insure against defaulting on a mortgage. Somebody might have wanted to not let that plane get repossessed.
Yeah,
David, your
right.
thoughts?
I mean, all those things are very much true. I mean, the plane, there was a lot of money to be had, and certainly the whole conspiracy theory behind Elvis's death is fascinating. The fact that I generally don't think in all the books have been written about, and there've been many, that really people have gone into that enough, and perhaps the answer to the whole Elvis mystery is there.
Annie, thank you for that. David, what are you working on next?
I've actually got a book about deaths that shook the world. So it's not you can see a theme coming on. It's kind of a wider look at various big events that had a worldwide effect, not just individuals, but occasions like 9/11 and some of the other kind of huge events that kind of shaken the world and made headlines and taking a new look at those situations and what happened.
How much time do you spend researching a book like that?
I mean, years, really. What I find, again, as I explained earlier, there's so much more that comes out after the effect. It's like if you investigate something straight afterwards, you know, there's a limited amount, but there's so many records now that you can go back and you can speak to people again, people who are very wary of speaking to you, you know, days and weeks after something happened. Couple of years later on, you get a much better perspective on an event that you think you knew everything about, and you think that, I think most people think they knew everything about. But to go back to it some years later on, it can bring up some fascinating aspects of it that really haven't been examined before. And that's what I've kind of, that's one of the big things I've kind of come across writing this book, that this perceived knowledge is very different when you look again at some of these huge events in our lives. You know, everyone knew supposedly where they were when Elvis died, and I think all of these people I wrote about, that shock factor. You know, when you hear what's happened, you know, John Lennon's and the Michael Jackson's, and you know, it's kind of a signpost to our lives to a certain extent. You know, you remember these things, you remember where you were, you remember what you're doing, and perhaps you remember your age. And what I've discovered is you look back at it 5-10 years later on, and so much more information is available.
Indeed. Well, David, congratulations on Murder, Lies, and Cover-Ups. We look forward to your next book. David Gardner, thank you. Sam and Dave taking us into the break, Soothe Me. And then after that, the sexy psychic, Sloan Bella, with us for the final 2 hours of Coast to Coast AM.